You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of August 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Sophie Grove.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the journey to military action against Syria slows down as the West goes to great lengths to ensure any intervention is thought through. We'll ask though, can it be lawful?
We'll also get the American perspective on Syria. Joining us today in the studio is Jeffrey Kaufman of ABC News.
And good morning. Yes, that's right. We'll be watching to see today and over the weekend just when the U.S. does attack, if they attack, because it's getting awfully lonely. The U.K., not part of it so far.
Plus, we head to the Museum of Modern Art in New York to experience their Soundings exhibition.
There are 16 speakers around us in the room, and what that creates is what's called an ambisonic chamber. So instead of us hearing sound coming from a particular spot in the room, we'll be effectively surrounded.
Also, we'll have a celebration of the rebirth of our city's high streets.
Really, I think what the high street is at its best is a civic space as well as just a retail space. It's a place of interaction. It's a place where a neighbourhood sees itself and the various parts of itself.
All that, plus we'll review this morning's European front pages and we'll play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
First though, let's catch up on the headlines with Paul Osborne.
President Obama says he's sure Syria was behind an attack with chemical weapons that killed hundreds of people. He's warned the strike has threatened America's national security, but says he has yet to decide whether to launch a military response. Mr. Obama says he won't authorize a large-scale intervention in Syria's civil war.
If, in fact, we can take limited, tailored approaches, not getting drawn into a long conflict, not a repetition of Iraq, which I know a lot of people are worried about, we send a shot across the bow saying, stop doing this. That can have a positive impact on our national security over the long term.
But Russia says the UN cannot discuss military action until inspectors currently in Damascus have reported back. Britain's parliament has been recalled to debate the crisis, but it won't be able to approve military action today. There's concern any strike on Syria could widen the conflict. But Matthew Levitt, who's the author of a book on the history of the Lebanese group Hezbollah, says it is unlikely to respond.
If it is a limited strike, I think it's far more likely that Iran and Hezbollah and Syria do nothing, or very, very little, and if anything, perhaps more asymmetric warfare, terrorism that's more difficult to attribute to a source and respond to than frontal attacks. I think Hezbollah, Syria, Iran have an interest in trying to lure Israel into this regional war.
There'll be talks within days between the government in Colombia and the country's second biggest rebel group. President Juan Manuel Santos announced the move after the ELN released a Canadian hostage it had been holding for several months. Colombian officials have already been in talks with the larger FARC rebel group. A former U.S. Army psychiatrist who killed 13 soldiers in an attack at a base in Texas is facing the death penalty. A military jury decided on execution in the case of Major Nidal Hassan for the attack at the Fort Hood base in Texas in 2009. He claimed he acted to protect Taliban insurgents in Afghanistan. Major Hassan's execution must be authorized by the president, but not until a series of appeals likely to take several years. Ministers in Egypt's interim government are warning the instability in recent weeks has had a huge impact on the economy. The country's budget deficit now stands at $200 billion, and confidence in the Egyptian economy has been hit after the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi. But Finance Minister Ahmed Galal insists things will improve.
We are trying to activate the economy. We are trying to impose financial discipline. And finally, we want to do both of them in a way that achieves social justice to the extent possible.
President Obama has joined thousands of people at an event in Washington, D.C., marking the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's famous I Have a Dream speech. Mr. Obama stood on the same spot where Dr. King made one of America's most famous speeches, telling the crowds that more must be done for that dream to come true. Loreline Jones was at the march 50 years ago and returned to Washington for the anniversary.
To come here was just the natural. I just didn't know the impact that this march would have. We were here with our college friends, and we just thought we were doing the right thing, marching for jobs. But then again, 50 years later, we're still marching for the same thing.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Paul. It's just coming up to 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And we kickstart today's programme with our agenda session. Normally we discuss three big subjects that we should all be thinking about. Today, I suspect it's just one.
Today, yes, our focus is on Syria, and we're joined in the studio by Geoffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News. Welcome to the show, Geoffrey.
Well, good morning. That's right. Really, it's the only story today, isn't it? What's going to happen? What is the U.S. going to do? And I guess the headlines this morning here in the U.K. that David Cameron, the Prime Minister, has had to do an about-face, he just isn't going to have the support today for the vote that he wanted to authorize military action. And so he's going to have to wait. And that puts Barack Obama in a very lonely place.
It does, perhaps, for the time being, although I think we heard in the last 24 hours that the UN has actually praised Barack Obama for not being trigger happy. I mean, does this actually give everybody a little bit more breathing space, perhaps?
Well, yes and no. I mean, listen, we all know that it's only 10 years since the votes on intervention in Iraq and the very hasty attacks on Saddam Hussein in advance of the UN reports on weapons of mass destruction. There is still, certainly here in the UK, there are still very strong memories of a sense of people being hoodwinked by the political leaders. And Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, said he just simply wasn't going to support in the minority government of David Cameron action until the UN report comes. And Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, has said that they will finish their inspections in Syria by tomorrow, but they'll need a little time to get some technical analysis. So all of that kind of delays it. Obama is under some time pressure to do this over the weekend. There are four cruise missile carrying destroyers in the Mediterranean waiting to go, and some more in the Gulf. And he really needs to move this forward because he's got, it's interesting how politics works. He has an agenda. He's going to Sweden on Tuesday, and then he goes to St. Petersburg for the G20 at the end of the week. So he doesn't want to be away. He's commander in chief. He can't be out of the country when the U.S. is attacking.
Especially in Russia.
And he can't be with Putin, who is the one person who's keeping up the Assad regime.
Should we talk about his statements yesterday? He used this phrase, a shot across the bows, which is quite striking in the context, really talking about what he would be prepared to do. Do you think that's quite significant at this stage?
We're talking about Obama's statements yesterday. Well, listen, he's trying to walk a line. I don't think there's anyone, even Putin, who thinks that it's acceptable to use chemical weapons. They've been banned internationally since 1925. And the evidence is clear that chemical weapons were used. What Obama is trying to do, though, is make a statement without actually getting involved or too involved. It's not about intervening. It's about not intervening, because he doesn't want to get he knows that Syria is going to be a quagmire, and that based on on what's happened in Afghanistan and Iraq, intervention isn't going to solve it. So, but at the same time, he feels, and I think a lot of Western leaders feel, I know, that they've got to make some sort of gesture. So he's trying to walk that line, do some damage to military installations, but not regime change.
It is that tricky thing, though, that once you start, you have this so-called mission creep. And there has been a wholesale criticism from pretty much every side that there's been no great talk about what could happen next? I mean, the French have said no boots on the ground, but we don't know where this is going to go, and we don't know what the long-term prospects for Syria are.
Well, to your first part, it's absolutely true. When you start something like this, you don't know where it will end. It's fine to say, well, we're just going to drop a couple of cruise missiles on Syria and then go back home and say, listen, you know, we made our point. But of course, it is such an unstable region right now. Israel sits there very vulnerable and on high alert. Iran is the wild card. It's propping up the Syrian regime. It has a somewhat more moderate leadership than it has had. We're not seeing the kind of rhetoric, although, you know, there are some who are saying in Iran that you attack Syria, we'll attack Israel. That seems less likely than it might have been a year or two ago. But still, it's at play there, and it's true. I mean, we look at Egypt, look at Syria, and you see, look at Yemen, and this roiling instability in the region. If you throw a match in there, you just don't know what you'll ignite.
It's quite interesting to look at the debate comparing this moment to Iraq, as you say, especially in the UK. It seems to be a constant point of reference. Do you think that's really, that's a really critical sort of memory point, especially for Europeans at this time?
I feel it very strongly, yeah. I think the people here felt very singed that Blair, what was Blair? Blair was Bush's poodle, you know, that Blair was really just doing what George Bush asked him to do, and that the UK was drawn into this conflict in a much grander scale than it might have been had all the facts been in. And clearly, I mean, it's interesting because the Labour leader here, Ed Miliband, is not a strong leader, but he has certainly taken the wind out of Cameron's sails by saying, "Wait a minute, you know, you're in a minority government here, you know." Cameron might have scraped by with a vote today, but he knew it was iffy because some of his own members were threatening not to support military action. And Cameron obviously did his numbers and said, you know, let's hold off. That's not what he was saying 24 hours ago. It was only late last night, London time, that he actually switched his tone. And Miliband clearly, I mean, he said, we cannot let the memory of the Iraq vote and our impulsiveness be forgotten. And so, yes, it's very much coloring. And there is no appetite anywhere for boots on the ground. There's no appetite for a huge invasion. And I think there's a realization that you've got this impossible circumstance in Syria where it's not like you've got good guys trying to overthrow bad guys. It's a much more layered and complex situation. If you were to knock off Assad, you may well have Islamic fundamentalists coming in and taking over the country. And so careful what you wish for.
I mean, we were discussing the legal aspect of any potential invasion at the moment, but we've been talking for some time now about accusations that the Obama administration has been weak in terms of its ability to take strong decisions on the international scale, on the international stage. Do you think, in actual fact, this is now playing in Obama's favour?
I think the world has changed. I don't think the U.S. can control the world. I mean, I think that yes, Obama isn't as strong as some of his predecessors, but that may in part be Obama and his tone. But I think a lot of it is just simply welcome to the world of the 21st century, where the superpowers don't control every action. And you know, part of what we're seeing in this what we've been calling the Arab Spring is the end of the superpower control, the hegemony of the region.
Geoffrey Kaufman from ABC News, thank you very much indeed for joining us. We're going to ask you to stay put for a little while because after this short break, we'll be talking about Syria, but the legality of any intervention. Stay with us.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, so much more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations, and stunning photography. We look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shiba Ken dog by your side, and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in good bookshops around the world and is also available to order now at monocle.com. Happy reading.
Welcome back to The Globalist. The US now says it's convinced that Syrian regime used chemical weapons in the last week's strike against a suburb of Damascus. Although the evidence clearly indicates that nerve agent sarin was used, the UN chemical weapons inspectors have yet to come back with their findings. So is America's course now set for unilateral action?
With any sanction for intervention by the UN Security Council unlikely to be granted due to Russia and China's support for the Assad regime, what are the options now? Can you legally bypass the UN? Well, to explore the legal aspects of this, we're joined on the line by Dr. Martin Dixon, an expert in international law from the University of Cambridge and a man who's worked as a UN lawyer in the Middle East. And we also have Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC News, who stayed with us in the studio. Welcome to the programme to you both. Martin, may I start with you? The fact that the UN Security Council is unlikely to pass any kind of resolution, are we looking at the end of legal argument and the beginning of people talking about political legitimacy now?
We're not quite at the end of legal argument yet. Failing a Security Council resolution, which doesn't look as if there will be a resolution, there's a couple of possibilities. Possibility number one is that intervention can be badged under the heading of self-defense. For example, if Turkey were to be attacked, that's a big NATO ally right on the border of Syria, if a NATO ally was attacked, or even anyone in the region was attacked, there is no doubt in those circumstances that the state attacked and its allies can use force to defend itself and to remove the threat. Attack is a fairly limited concept, but some people argue that a state can be attacked because it is suffering what they might call refugee aggression. So hundreds of thousands of refugees streaming across the border, putting pressure on resources, threats to the peace, and so on and so on. So one option, albeit remote, is that action could be taken militarily as an act of self-defense. That doesn't seem likely. The second option, much less certain as to its legality, is very similar to what happened in Kosovo in 1999, when NATO undertook limited military action in order to protect the Kosovan civilians who were being attacked at that time by the then Yugoslavian government. There was a limited military intervention, consequent actually upon a Security Council failure, which was designed to protect the civilians. That really is the more likely plausible legal argument. But it's only plausible. It's not certain. Many countries would argue that there's no rule permitting humanitarian intervention with force. So we're in delicate legal waters with those two possibilities.
And Jack Straw, who was in the cabinet in the UK, has talked quite a lot about how international law has changed since Iraq, enabling perhaps intervention without the legal wranglings that happened before. Do you see that there is any sort of altering to the framework as we see it today?
The only possible change in the way that international law responds to this is as a result of the Kosovo action. Prior to that, the UK government in particular was very clearly against using force to support, protect, uphold human rights obligations. The UK had a record, along with most other governments, of saying that while they understood the motives, it was still unlawful. The international community's reaction to Kosovo has led some people to believe that international law has become, as it were, a little bit more open-ended when it comes to human rights intervention. But it's more wishful thinking than it is concrete law. You can see why the rest of the world, the other 190-odd members of the United Nations, might regard intervention to protect human rights with deep suspicion. Whose human rights? When is there a violation? Is it a cover for regime change? It's a very difficult, challenging area for actors, those using force, to rely on that principle. It isn't widely accepted, And there isn't overwhelming evidence of a change in view.
Jeffrey Kaufman, let's bring you in here. The US president is a former lawyer. How much do you think that this is actually cooling his head?
I think that he sees this very much as a political situation, and I think he sees it also as one that is deeply tinged with a moral tone to it, because a chemical attack in particular is so repugnant. I mean, it's interesting when you think that we know that the regime, after the coup in Egypt, has killed over 1,000 people, and yet they're taking an incredibly passive approach to condemning what's gone on in Egypt, and yet 300 we know to have died. Reports this morning that the UN inspectors are finding over 1,000 have died, and that just, there's a trigger when it comes to chemical weapons, and so it becomes a moral and political imperative that requires response. I think that's very much what's on Obama's mind.
Jeffrey, a moment, you just mentioned there the fact that the UN chemical weapons inspectors are still doing their job. And yesterday, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was urging the world to give diplomacy a chance. Martin Dixon, I'll ask you to listen to this. This is a defence editor from the Evening Standard here in London talking to me a little earlier on about how strong he believes the United Nations is in situations like this.
The UN is a very, very bad instrument for action, as we know, that they authorize things. I mean, I'm thinking back to Rwanda and so on, but particularly, you know, the wars of humanitarian intervention of the 1990s. And the UN has a dreadful capability of giving with one hand and taking with the other. And I think that Mr. Ban is proving himself a very interesting and pretty capable UN General Secretary. But he must be aware of that, and he must be worried about sending very ambiguous signals. But we should really be talking about the General Assembly. They need to be persuaded, and I'm not sure that they will be fully or effectively enough.
Martin Dixon, you're a former UN lawyer in the Middle East. Do you agree with what is said there, that the UN is a bad instrument for action?
It's quite easy to blame the UN for inaction, really. We often sort of make the mistake, I think, of pretending that the UN exists in a vacuum, that it's a body all by itself. The UN is made up of 193 states. Real power in the UN lies in the Security Council, 15 states. Those are real governments with real people. When the United Nations doesn't act, it is the governments of the world who are failing to act. The UN has no sense of its own moral purpose. It's a body with members. So the failure to act in Syria lies at the door of the members of the UN rather than the UN itself. It's an easy target, the UN, in these circumstances. Look at it slightly differently.
And Martin, I would add that when you talk about the Security Council, we're really talking about Russia and China, in particular, though, Russia. Putin is the Assad regime's closest ally on the Security Council and just doesn't want to support any actions by the U.S., still claiming, at least publicly, that this must have been a rebel attack on itself. And so you're right. The UN Security Council can't be terribly effective when it's got one or two of its major members, most influential members, saying, well, we're not sure we want to do this.
Dr. Martin Dixon and Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you both for joining us on the programme today.
After this short break, we'll be heading to Auckland for the latest on the botulism scare that turned out to be all right, after all.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Wei yu London, this is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
The time is 19:24 in Auckland, 8:24 a.m. here in London. We head to New Zealand next.
Simon Farrell-Green is our man on the ground, and he's on the line from New Zealand. Welcome to the show, Simon.
Thank you.
So, some very big news for New Zealanders. A high-profile milk powder scare, which caused huge repercussions, millions of dollars worth of products thought to be discarded and contaminated, actually turns out to be a mistake. Can you tell us how this all came about.
It's just extraordinary, really, isn't it? I mean, it goes back, you know, about a month to when Fonterra is the world's fourth biggest dairy company. It's our biggest company by miles. And they announced that some of their milk powder had been contaminated with botulism, thanks to what has only ever been known as a dirty pipe. But no one's really ever been able to tell us what pipe it was or what it was doing or anything like that. Huge scare, massive product recall. I mean, the repercussions for New Zealand of a dairy scare can't be underestimated. You're talking about, you know, billions of dollars worth of export earnings. You know, this was so serious the New Zealand dollar dipped overnight on the news of it. Heads were, you know, various people have lost jobs. There was all sorts of gnashing of teeth. And then yesterday it emerged that actually it was a false positive. And after retesting in the United States, there's nothing to worry about. It's just extraordinary. Everyone here is gobsmacked.
I think the chairman of the Infant Formula Exporters Association has basically said that this has highlighted a big problem in the way that New Zealand deals with its health scares.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think one of the things that's come out about this is New Zealanders, despite the fact that they, you know, we are an export nation, in particularly with regard to dairy, we don't quite understand as a country how worried the rest of the world is about food. We come from a country where everything is clean, food is safe. We don't have those sorts of issues. And what was acutely sort of prescient about this whole thing was the fact that, you know, most of this milk powder had actually gone to China. And, of course, China has massive concerns around food safety. So everything was sort of handled in a pretty amateur way, right from clearly the testing in the first place through to the way that this, you know, was communicated with media and partners both in China and in New Zealand. And I think we as a country just need to really get our act together and understand how important this sort of stuff is for the rest of the world. But the whole thing has just really been mismanaged from the start.
And Simon, how do you think, you know, they'll compensate really Fonterra for all this damage, as you say, not just to their reputation, but financially? Is there any talk of how they're going to sort of make up for lost time, really?
The issue, interestingly, and this is where it becomes really interesting, is not so much with Fonterra. Fonterra's pretty bulletproof. You know, at the end of the day, they're exporting something that is in hot demand, particularly through Asia. And, you know, the latest dairy auction, which sets the price for the next 3 months, was a record high for the year. So, you know, there's been very little damage to them apart from the recall of, you know, a few million dollars worth of stock, which in the context of their total business is nothing. Where it's really caused an issue is for the people downstream, the businesses buying the milk powder and then turning it into, say, infant formula. Those guys have been very badly affected, and a couple of them have said they're looking at their legal options, and they may well sue the Ministry for Primary Industries here, which is the ministry in charge of the whole thing. And rightly so, I would say. You know, this is terrible, obviously, for them in the short term, and really not good for their brand either.
Simon, let's move on to a political hunt that has begun. New Zealand's Labour Party is after another leader.
Yeah, this will be their third leader since the last election, which is getting a little bit close to the next election, in fact, which is just over a year away. So after the last election, they deposed their former leader, and there was a very public leadership run. And a man named David Shearer, who's a former aid worker, relatively new MP, he'd only been in politics for 2 years by that point, became the very unlikely winner of that competition, but really has really been unable to lift the polls. They've added about 5%, but there have been several controversies this year that really the opposition should have been capitalising on. And so a week ago, he very honourably stepped aside. And so we now have another leadership battle on our hands.
And Simon, I just wanted to ask you very finally about Wellington's bus fleet. Some fire hazards. It looks like half of it's going to be junked.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? So Wellington is not a very large city. It has 108 buses in total, and 28 of those have been taken off the road in the last day, thanks to oil leaks, which are potentially flammable. It's really worrying. The bus company concerned is saying that it's all being blown out of proportion, but if I was a Wellington commuter, I wouldn't be very happy at all.
Nor a bus driver either, I'd imagine.
Well, exactly.
Shocking stuff there in Wellington. Simon Farrell-Green in Auckland, many thanks for coming on the show. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be examining the rebirth of our city's high streets. We'll head to the MoMA in New York and we'll review the European front pages. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
President Obama says he's not yet made a final decision on whether to order military strikes on Syria. But he says he is sure the Syrian regime was behind an attack with chemical weapons in which hundreds of people were killed. Britain's parliament has been recalled to debate the crisis, but it won't vote today to sanction military action. Russia, meanwhile, has warned the UN can't consider any resolution on Syria until inspectors currently in Damascus have reported back to the Security Council. Colombia's president says he's ready to start peace talks with the country's second biggest rebel group, the ELN. Juan Manuel Santos says talks will start as soon as possible. The announcement came the day after the ELN released a Canadian hostage it had been holding for several months. Police in India have arrested the alleged head of a militant group, the Indian Mujahideen. It had been blamed for a series of recent explosions across the country. Yasin Bhatal, who's one of India's most wanted men, is thought to have been detained near the border with Nepal. A military jury has sentenced a former U.S. Army psychiatrist to death over a mass shooting at a base in Texas. Major Nidal Hassan was convicted last week over the shooting at the Fort Hood base, in which 13 soldiers were killed and 32 others injured. A bookmaker in Australia has started paying out on a Conservative victory in the country's general election, even though there's more than a week of campaigning left. Sportsbet says it's clear that the right-wing coalition led by Tony Abbott will defeat Kevin Rudd's ruling Labour Party next weekend. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove and Emma Nelson. We've all been warned about the decline of the high street. Many are struggling with high vacancy rates, bereaved of small businesses. And to make matters worse, by all accounts, we've opted to shop online. But apparently this is no longer the case.
Because high streets have become a place of unrivalled opportunity. For this week's episode of The Urbanist, Andrew Tuck met two people who've worked to renew parts of London that were once off the map. They're Alex Arestis, Associate Director at the urban consultancy Publica, and Beverly Churchill, a Marketing and Communications Director for the property developers Capco.
Primarily, it's about control. And I think the problem some of those high streets face is they have a multitude of owners and a multitude, therefore, of different motivations behind the decisions they make about leasing and retail and how that leads on to kind of an overall mix and an overall vibe. We are control freaks, but we're control freaks because we think it's a positive thing to allow us to curate the district. And certainly the way we curate the district is with a very clear view about how we have to compete with all the different areas, e-commerce and everything else. It has to be about more than just shopping.
Now, Alex, a company like yours may be brought in all sorts of projects at all levels of retail and commerce. Now, looking at somewhere like Covent Garden, it's middle to upper end. But many of the places that we're talking about failing these days are perhaps middle to lower end. But do you think there's some of those lessons there, that idea that you need a singular vision, and that actually, even when we're doing a kind of more basic retailing, that we want it to be an enjoyable experience? Is there something there that can be dragged into the debate that you're involved in?
Absolutely. I mean, we work both in the West End and looking at kind of outer borough high streets and in different locations around London especially. And I think there's definitely a different context, as Beverly's touched on that point about a single owner or a major landlord who can really push through and be a catalyst for change and things is very important. And it is generally missing from those other high streets that I think you're describing. However, that kind of idea of having an overall strategy is something I think that can absolutely be taken to different locations. And that can come through a kind of local government or perhaps now in these developing ideas of neighborhood plans or kind of different bodies that can try and maybe commission those kind of strategies at the early stages. Also, I think the idea of the mix is absolutely vital. So even on a kind of what you might say a kind of bog standard high street, getting the mix right, getting a mix between different people and different kinds of retail is vital. And then having that mix engender lots of different journeys, lots of different kinds of footfall, because really I think what the high street is at its best is a civic space as well as just a retail space. It's a place of interaction. It's a place where a neighborhood sees itself and the various parts of itself. So getting events, getting some civic uses along a high street as well as retail, some major anchors, some major chains perhaps, but then allowing the more independent mix and the more specific retail in as well, I think is important, because high streets, especially in a city where you have multiple retail locations, they're not just only for that neighborhood. I mean, you need that neighborhood amenity, but perhaps you want to think about being a bit more specialized and having a reason to go there as opposed to heading into town or going to a retail mall.
Now, Beverly, Capco's involved in perhaps some of the biggest and most exciting projects for London. This is the redevelopment around Earls Court, where you're going to be, well, you're building a new district for the city.
Yeah.
And that will have a high street. Does that allow you to rethink what the high street should be? You go back to basics and think, okay, what kind of mix do we need? Which shops are not going to be successful here? And what will we need?
Absolutely. It's starting from a blank sheet of paper, although we are very mindful of the fabric of the city around us. Earls Court will be, in our view, we talk about this idea of London Plus, this idea of London as you know it, but slightly better, slightly improved, where people have had a chance to think about some of the things that don't necessarily work well and put them right. So the high street's a huge and very exciting opportunity for us. But in that context, we do see it about being this civic and social hub. And for us, it's not only going to be a place where you can go and find really interesting stores and really amazing restaurants and cafes and bars and, you know, even a local pub, but things like a health centre and schools and, you know, those things that bring communities together at key times throughout the day, the week, the year.
Now, Alex, that's an interesting idea because, you know, I think there are some 48,000 empty shops now in the UK, and that's down to lots of things. You know, we allowed a huge amount of out-of-town development, which killed many of our high streets, but now we have e-commerce wiping out another kind of layer of stores. What do we do with all those empty units? Now, Beverly has a great opportunity. She's starting from scratch. But do other high streets need to think, actually, maybe one of these shop fronts should be a lawyer's office, or it should be for startup businesses, or it should be, you know, a public space?
I think we're at a very interesting point in the UK in terms of how those shop units, which generally a lot of it was Victorian building stock, are now going to be occupied. I think in some cases, maybe it is right to think about it not being retail. Maybe it's offices, maybe it's some civic community. Maybe it does actually revert to housing in some cases. Although I would say that I think once a high street's gone to residential, it's very hard to get it back probably. I think it kind of depends where you are. And I think the starting point for all our work at Publica is always to really look at the context, the local context, and then the policy frameworks kind of that are overarching that. So I think there's going to be different solutions in different places. I think what's interesting to me is that where you have a major landowner, let's say, they will sometimes actually subsidize a high street because they know that that is a very important part of what makes a neighborhood livable. So if you can have the kind of commercial demographic setting where that actually makes financial sense for a large company, you think, well, then it's vital in other places where we have a more fragmented ownership and perhaps we don't have such, you know, high levels of wealth, to really try and protect and to invest and to nurture the high street as an integral part of what makes a bit of the city or a small town work.
And Alex, tell me, you know, the idea of this, you know, you bump into each other and your neighbours down the high street. For social cohesion, the high street is oddly important and perhaps something we've forgotten a little bit, because, you know, you strip away that high street and then unless you go to the pub or unless you go to, you know, one or two other kind of sporting things maybe connected with your town, there's very little of that kind of chance encounter goes on, is there?
Absolutely. I mean, in a kind of big metropolitan place like London, you know, I think we all tend to live in kind of different groups that overlay each other, both geographically and socially. And you're not necessarily just linked to your neighborhood. However, despite that, I think people still feel their neighborhood is incredibly important to them. It's incredibly important to where you want to live. If you have children, if you're an older person, the idea that the high street is somewhere where you can walk to, you can cycle to, and a short journey, see people, have interactions, and kind of get that sense of community, even if it's on, you know, quite a kind of gentle level, I think is really vital. I think people see it as an important part of their quality of life, absolutely.
Alex Orestis and Beverly Churchill there, talking to Monocle's Andrew Tuck about the high street. That was for this week's edition of The Urbanist. You can catch the full discussion at 1900 hours London time here on Monocle 24. In the meantime, though, you're listening to Midori House with Emma Nelson and Sophie Grove. Stay with us, because after this, we head to the MoMA in New York.
From market to table, the history of Sicily can be interpreted through its rich cuisine. Monocle Films traces the island's past with a tasty visit to a hands-on cooking school.
It's not so much about the recipe, but it's exactly about an experience. My dream is to offer to the people who come here an experience of a style of life that starts from the soil and arrives to the table.
A Taste of Sicily, in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is nearly 8:42 here in London. Now, the first group exhibition at New York's Museum of Modern Art to single out sound as a form of artistic expression opened earlier this month.
It's called Soundings, a Contemporary Score, and it features the work of 16 contemporary artists who all work with sound and explore the medium through field recordings, visualisations and a range of interpretations. Monocle's Pauline Eiferman met Leora Marinis, curatorial assistant for the exhibition. They had a private tour of the show.
We are approaching Florian Hecker's piece, Affordance, from 2013, and it is a three-channel work with three images. Each speaker is programmed individually. Sometimes the sounds correspond, but sometimes they're operating autonomously, and the images themselves are also each distinct, though affined in certain ways.
So the idea is to be walking and hearing the sound through the stairway.
Right. Yes, exactly. And Hecker himself says that he's trying to disrupt our bifurcated listening. So typically we can hear things from two ears and put them together pretty simultaneously into a cohesive whole. Again, with three speakers, we can't really do that. So it calls on us to sort of stumble a little before we can understand what we're hearing.
This is the first time that the MoMA has such a major exhibition, group exhibition on sound out, right? What is difficult about doing an exhibition on sound?
In terms of logistics, it is difficult to create an installation that doesn't create kind of antagonistic or competing situations where the pieces end up being compromised. That being said, I'm actually a fan of there being a little bit of sound bleed. So we'll see that there are moments in the show where you can hear a couple of pieces at once in the hallway spaces. Then when you go into the individual rooms, the sound is cleaner, clearer. But those moments of overlap allow narratives to form that wouldn't if these were all discrete shows, or as some of the artists say, they're always asked to do installations in staircases or in elevators or in these kind of interstitial spaces where they can be relegated and not compete with each other and other works. So it's exciting to have it more centralized than that. Sound has been in the public consciousness for a long time now. That being said, there does seem to be a popular interest that is new or that is rising. And so people seem to be very excited about this show. They're also fearless. People are willing to just get right up to the works and engage with their bodies. It's pretty clear that people understand that where they stand, where their physical, you know, presence is, affects dramatically what they hear. And that's exciting to see. I wasn't sure that people would be so willing to interact. So we just walked by Tristan Parrish's Microtonal Wall, which is a piece of 1,500 individually tuned speakers. They're 1-bit microprocessors, which is the most sort of rudimentary or crude type of speaker instrument there is. And they're tuned individually to make a wall or a continuum of pitch that shifts as you walk along it.
And one of the things I read about this exhibition is that it kind of takes sound from a very personal and private experience to a more communal one. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There is a tendency, particularly today, to listen to sound on your earbuds or on your computer, to have an individualized or a cellular experience of sound. And we made a point of not doing that. There are no headphones. There are really no positions in which you can be alone in this show. To point to the fact that sound is, by its very nature, spatial. It takes over whatever space it's poured into. So we wanted that sort of bodily effect to be underscored here. So what we're about to hear is Jana Winderen's Ultrafields, and it's a new piece from this year. And what you'll be hearing is the sounds of bats and these bugs called backswimmers that swim on the surface of the water. And both of these are animals that you wouldn't be able to hear with the naked human ear because their frequencies are too high or too low. So what Winderen has done is pitched them down to our range. There are 16 speakers around us in the room, and what that creates is what's called an ambisonic chamber. So instead of us hearing sound coming from a particular spot in the room, we'll be effectively surrounded. So you'll feel like you're in the environment with these bugs and bats. An interesting origin story with this piece is Jana was in a park and she was walking at dusk, and suddenly bats encircled her. They were circling around her head, flying, which sounds a little terrifying, but to her it was moving because she realized, even though she couldn't hear it, that with their echolocation they were forming a sonic portrait of her face. So they could tell, you know, her contours and what she looked like just by what they were doing. So what she's created effectively is a room in which all of our portraits are being taken when we're in there.
Leora Marinis from the MoMA speaking to our Pauline Eiferman.
In a moment, we review what the British and European press have been covering today amongst some comedy and Skype. But before that, this is Tom Adele and Another Love. Tom Adele there and another love on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Sophie Grove and Emma Nelson. Time now, before the end of the show, to take a look at the front pages of the British and European press. And Steve Bloomfield joins us in the studio to help us do just that.
Sophie, hello. Emma,
hi.
Hello. Hi.
Good morning.
I'm actually going to dive into the middle of the pages rather than the front pages because, as you can imagine, the front pages pretty much ever in the world are covering Syria, a topic which obviously we've covered in some depth earlier on today. Having said that, I want to start with Syria because there are two competing op-eds, one in the Financial Times, one in the Independent, looking at the legacy of Iraq, which is, of course, particularly in the UK and to a certain extent in the US as well, the one thing that's being the one historical analogy that's being talked about. Gideon Rackman in the Financial Times is saying echoes of the Iraq war are eerie but misleading. And he makes some good points. He says, look, last time around, there's this issue of weapons of mass destruction. Are there any? Well, yes, we know there are because they've been used. Then there was the issue of do we trust the intelligence? And last time you had Bush and Blair who really wanted this war to happen for various reasons. And there was pressure on the intelligence services to make it fit. This time it's the opposite. Obama doesn't want this war. He would far rather if no one had come to him to say, sorry, sir, but there seem to be chemical weapons here.
In fact, it's Cameron who's beating the drum the loudest.
Exactly. So Rackman makes this interesting case that it's sort of, despite the fact that we're, you know, saying that this is like Iraq. He always makes the other point about the coalition as well, supporting them, that that remember that, you know, Jacques Chirac and Gerhard Schroeder were very much against the last operation. The French are leading the charge this time. The Germans are supportive, the Turks even as well. However, Steve Richards in The Independent says that there are some similarities from a British perspective, particularly looking at how the support of the main political parties for an American-led war appears to be quite similar. And also this is the phrasing as well, the idea that we must take action, that inaction is not an option, we can't stand aside and do nothing. He sees some sort of similarities with Iraq there.
It is an astonishing thing, the way that, in fact, Cameron has been positioned. I think The Independent had an amazing just front line a couple of days ago saying Cameron is heir to Blair. Do we find ourselves in a position where we're actually stuck in an Iraq hangover and not enough distinction is being made? I mean, you've just listed them, the things that Gideon Rackman have said, of you know, make it absolutely clear and apparent that that Syria and Iraq are two completely different things.
Yeah, I think it is quite difficult because also we're finding, you know, a lot of commentators are talking about, you know, this person was for the Iraq, was opposed to the Iraq war, but now they're in favour of Syria, as if they're two things, and if it's somehow hypocritical to be, you know, against one but in favour of the other. You know, Iraq had such an important impact on British political life. I think it really can't be overstated how much of an impact it had. And so I guess it's only natural that that's the prism through which so many people are seeing Syria now. Two other things I wanted to talk about briefly as well. There's a good piece about Skype in the FT. Everyone loves Skype. Everyone uses Skype. But this piece says that Skype's first decade reflects a trail of missed opportunities. The free call group continues to grow, but success could have been wider. And I think they make this interesting point that essentially they stopped innovating as soon as you had video calling from 2005. And as someone who lived abroad and someone who now has family abroad, you know, I use it all the time and it's great. But it didn't, you know, like say Twitter, you know, move on in any sort of way.
It didn't capture the sort of imagination of teenagers and social groups in the same way. Finally, let's talk about rather exciting happening in Edinburgh, a new Perrier Award winner, a woman.
Yes.
This is quite a big deal in the comedy circles.
Yes. So the Perrier Award, or whatever it's known as now, is the big comedy award at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. It's the big comedy award in the UK. And it's just gone to Bridget Christie, who's a feminist comedian, which some people say is a bit of an oxymoron because, you know, it's political. You can't be political with comedy. But she's brilliant. She's been previously known as the wife of Stuart Lee. It now seems that Stuart Lee is going to be known as the husband of Bridget Christie. A great interview with her in The Guardian by Rebecca Nicholson. If you get a chance to see her show when it comes to London, or when I'm sure it travels elsewhere in the world, do go and see it because it will be wonderful.
Bridget Christie dominating a swathe of lady comedians at the Edinburgh Fringe this year. It's been an absolutely sort of a vintage year for them. Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, thank you very much indeed for bringing us up to speed with the newspapers. That's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producers Phil Hahn and Alad John, to our researcher Fernanda Augusto Pacheco and to Marie-Sophie Swatcher and our studio manager Alex Funnell. Up next after the news is Culture with Robert Bound.
Emma will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow with Clemency Burton Hill. But for me, Sophie Grove.
And me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye and thank you very much for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.